The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What would make America safe? Donald Trump and Ted Cruz proposed to close borders and carpet bomb ISIS strongholds. Democrats Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders say that would make the homeland more vulnerable to retaliation. Fighting terrorism in the Middle East is one thing, but the fear of homegrown, self-radicalized individuals operating undetected and striking on American soil bumps up the level of dread. And then there's the risk of gun violence, which far outpaces the 1 in 20 million chance of being killed in a terrorist attack. Still, if that 1 in 20 million is your child, the threat feels real. So, is America safe? Not 100%, says security expert Juliette Kayyem, and that's a good thing. Juliette is former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and author of Security Mom, an unclassified guide to protecting our homeland and your home. She recently wrote an op-ed on the upside of vulnerability for the Washington Post. And Juliette, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So as a security expert, people often ask you how to keep their family safe. How do you advise them?
So I talk in terms of the word safer. Safe is a fanciful standard that we've never had, right? We didn't have it before September 11th, don't have it after. What we can do as parents, as community members, as leaders, is to minimize the risk to ourselves and our communities, maximize the defenses, right? So you wear helmets, you prepare for something bad happening, get vaccinated, and also just about your lead up about Trump. We have to maintain who we are as a state, as the United States, right? That we can't cower to fear about a threat that we're never going to get to zero.
Well, you make the point in your op-ed that the country was built to be vulnerable.
Yes.
Now, why should that come as a relief?
Well, because the alternative is either fanciful or unattainable. I mean, there's no alternative, right? So, and I say we were built unsafe in the way, look, we have a system of government in which we have mayors with power and governors with power and a federal government. We have borders that, despite what you hear about immigration debates, we enjoy having open borders to the extent that millions of people cross in and out of this country every week, and that's a good thing. We have airport transportation. About 2 million people are up in the air at any given moment in time. We like our iPhones and the commercial activity that we can access because of them. I often say, as a mother of three children, you know, you can't take away my Amazon Prime, right? If I order something on a Wednesday, I want it on a Thursday. That's a level of vulnerability in our system. And so just remembering that it's the flow of people and goods and ideas that makes this country amazing, that's inherently risky, right? It's you're not going to have a fortress America and live the kind of lives that we actually want.
Well, you're talking about setting up safety versus convenience or living
Yeah.
our way of life. And we heard a lot about, you know, maintaining our way of life after 9/11. We cannot cower in fear or the terrorists win. How is it different now? How has the threat changed since then?
Well, I think it's changed in two ways. I mean, first is the terrorist threat is more like what we've seen in the last 5 years. And people in my field, we call it sort of whack-a-mole counterterrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just that men, mostly converts in this country to Islam, are becoming radicalized online. They have easy access to guns or weaponry. And there's an infinite number of soft targets, right? You're not going to make every soft target hard. It would be impossible to do. So that kind of threat is going to exist. It's not an existential threat, but it's also it's hard to deter every single one of them. So we'll have some level of those kinds of attacks for the foreseeable future. I say that matter-of-factly, not to terrify people or to say, you know, what will be, just that's a sort of matter of reality. The other aspect that's changed, and this has certainly been true of the Homeland Security and the safety and security apparatus, is there's a lot more things that harm us than just terrorism, right? And you talked about gun safety, but also climate change and Ebola and Zika and oil spills and, you know, all the things that can happen that are disruptions to our system and that make us vulnerable. And so I very much in the book and in what I do now is talk about preparing ourselves for the potential disruptions in our life, talking to our children, preparing our homes. With basic provisions, right? You know, having documents, our important documents, having copies of them, mailing them out of state so that someone outside the state has them, and communicating plans of action to ensure family reunification after a potential incident. I'll tell you, I've been in this field a long time. The most important thing when something goes bad is family unification. It is the only thing people care about. And so we, as people who have kids or parents or aunts and uncles or whoever we are, really need to talk through how would that work in the event of some disruption, whatever it may be.
Is America 100% safe from terrorism? No, says security expert Juliette Kayyem, and that is a good thing. She's author of the new book, Security Mom, An Unclassified Guide to Protecting Our Homeland and Your Home. So you're describing a kind of fine line between a security mom and a prepper mom. I mean,
yeah.
Obviously, you do anything to protect your children. What would you not do?
Oh, I would. I mean, there's a lot. I wouldn't keep them home. I wouldn't keep them from traveling. There's essentially nothing I wouldn't let them do. I'm not a proponent of guns, so obviously, we don't have a gun in the home. But there's a lot of things they can do that also are coupled with minimizing the risk to doing it. And it's so obvious. It's like in some ways, you know, people just recognize that. So, you know, we have a family plan. So if something were to happen, my kids actually know what to do. They have backup plans just in case I'm not around or my husband isn't. I mean, you know, you can empower your children in ways that gives them grip over a world that you can't hide them from. I mean, this idea that I hear from my own girlfriends, like, I don't want them to know about what's going on, you know, after Paris or Belgium. And I'm thinking, they have an iPhone. Like, they're already there, right? They're already part of that world. Mm. So better for you to give it meaning and process and empower them than to pretend like you can hide them from the world that they will be a part of relatively soon.
I'm going to pull back for a minute to the political rhetoric, because this is, you know, the ways that policymakers or potential policymakers are talking about changes. First, they point to this being the most dangerous time in our nation's history, the threats never more intense. Is there evidence to back that up?
No. I mean, it's a fantasy that forgets, you know, several world wars, the Civil War, and potential nuclear Armageddon. The threat we face, if I just focus on terrorism, is a threat. There's no question about it. It is not existential. I have much more confidence in America's form of government and in our Constitution. We are not going to crumble at the feet of ISIS. It is a threat, but it is not one that is on par with much greater threats that this country has faced. And so if we can put it in perspective, then it won't seem as scary and people won't be as freaked out about it actually the poll suggests, which is people are very worried about it right now.
How about closing our borders to refugees and asylum seekers? What's your advice on that?
I think it's one of the worst paths we could take as a nation. And I don't say that as some, you know, peace-loving, you know, white flag, you know, can't everyone just get along? I am a hardcore safety and security person. If you asked me in the course of America's history, what has made us safer as a nation, immune from the challenges in the Middle East or the ethnic divisions that have plagued Europe for most of its history, it's not just our oceans, which helps. It's not just our geography. It is our capacity and capability as a nation, not perfect all the time, I'll grant you that, to accept and assimilate and embrace the other, whether it's Irish, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, or Muslims, that we have embraced new communities that then feel invested in the future of America's safety and security. That has been our long-term strategy for having a more stable nation, and it has worked. So anything we do that isolates a religion, that either internally, right, you know, targeting mosques or surveying certain communities, or even externally to the globe, is only going to undermine the one thing that America is very good at, and that the rest of the world looks at and thinks, wow, I wish we could do it that way.
Well, I think what I'm hearing from you is, you know, you're talking about sort of tolerating vulnerability. I mean, unless we're willing to say we're not going to have any more marathons, you know,
right.
You have a risk. So it feels like an attitude. Is there an attitude of countering fear that you recommend we adopt?
Well, it is. I mean, I call it grip, right? It's important that people understand what grip means. It means you're empowered with the tools and the information and even the resources to prepare yourself and your family and your community for whatever challenges come their way. So I'll tell you what it's not. It's not, never again, Fortress America, we can be safe and strong all the time. It's also not passive. It's not, if we just kept calm and carried on, everything would be fine. It's in between those two. It's in between tuning out and freaking out. It is the way most of us lead our lives in our personal capacity, right? We try to prepare for eventualities, pivot when things go wrong, be flexible in the face of changes to the plan. And that's what we can do also for our homeland security.
Juliet Kayyem, former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and author of the new book, Security Mom, An Unclassified Guide to Protecting Your Homeland and Your Home. Well, happy Security Mother's Day, Juliet.
Thank you so much.
There's more in the book, and you can see her opinion piece, No, America Isn't 100% Safe from Terrorism, and that's a good thing. The links are at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What was once a slip-up or scandal whispered among townsfolk can now be spread across the world with lightning speed. Cultural anthropologists regard shame and the attendant threat of ostracism as tools societies use for indoctrinating children and for maintaining order. But who needs the stockade or public shunning when we have Twitter? John Ronson profiles victims, perpetrators, and researchers of humiliation in his book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. We spoke to him last year when the book first came out. It's now out in paperback. I began by asking John about a mass public disgrace that hit us pretty close to home. Well, I'd like to start with Jonah Lehrer, because he was a guest on our very first Word of Mouth program, a young hotshot pop science writer in the Malcolm Gladwell mode, who resigned from The New Yorker in shame. Remind us, please, of how it was discovered that he'd made up quotes and attributed them to Bob Dylan.
Right. So Michael Moynihan, who's a journalist and a blogger, just happened to notice that there were these quotes in chapter one of Jonah's last book called Imagine, these Bob Dylan quotes that just didn't sound like Bob Dylan. You know, we all know how kind of spiky and arch and kind of, you know, Bob Dylan was. And yet the quotes in Jonah's book, you know, made Bob Dylan actually kind of sound a little bit like Jonah Lehrer. and also there were famous quotes like, Bob Dylan says in the movie Don't Look Back, when he's reading an article about himself and how he smokes 80 a day, Bob Dylan says, wow, I'm glad I'm not me. Mm. And in Jonah Lehrer's book, the quote was, I'm glad I'm not me, I'm glad I'm not that.
Mm.
So Michael realized that Jonah had been kind of manipulating Bob Dylan quotes, you know, for his own ends. So he emailed Jonah, and Jonah made the most human but terrible mistake of basically saying to Michael, no, you know, my quotes are correct. It's history that's wrong. Mm. You know, I went back to it. So he panicked and dug himself in deeper. And for a smart man, everything Jonah did was really stupid. But, you know, human.
I think all of us can understand that. You know, you make a big mistake and try to cover it up. And meanwhile, Jonah Lehrer at this time is a fancy writer living in a fancy mid-century modern home in L.A. and exposed by the kind of person, a man who described himself as a schlub to you several times, who used to be powerless. This seems to me like the kind of wonderful/horrible thing about Twitter.
Mm. You know, I said to Twitter when I was writing my book, something has happened, I think, I can't remember exactly, but there was some public shaming. I mean, my God, there's been so many. And I said, are we becoming a kangaroo court? And somebody wrote back, not a kangaroo court, just commentary, only unlike you, John, we're not getting paid for it.
Huh.
So the worst transgression on Twitter, and this is, you know, the worst, you know, the most shameworthy thing nowadays in our society is people who misuse privilege. Jonah misused privilege. That's what people have got for these days. And of course, it's better. You know, that's a better target than somebody involved in some kind of consensual sex scandal. You know, back in Puritan times, you'd get whipped for having an affair. You know, these days you get destroyed for misusing your privilege. Mm-hmm. But and so, of course, you know, we can support that more. But the problem is that we've so fallen in love with attacking people who've misused their privilege that we now attack people who kind of aren't privileged and haven't really done anything wrong.
Well, at least that was the case with Justine Sacco. Remind us of Justine Sacco, a young publicist on her way to a flight from New York City to Cape Town. What happened with her?
So she stops off at Heathrow and writes, you know, trying to be like Colbert, writes, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white.
Hmm.
So, you know, she was following in the tradition of, you know, Randy Newman has written plenty of songs along those lines, lots of episodes of South Park, you know, Colbert. The difference between Justine and those people was that she wasn't good at it.
Hmm.
So she didn't get any replies, which didn't surprise her because she only had 170 Twitter followers and she never got any replies. She still felt that kind of sadness that we all feel when the internet doesn't congratulate us for being funny. And then got on the plane and turned off her phone and slept and then woke up 10 hours later, turned on her phone and a text came up from somebody she hadn't spoken to since high school that said, I am so sorry to see what's happening to you. And then her phone just exploded, and, you know, with texts and alerts. And her best friend said, you need to phone me right away. You are the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter.
And she became instantly infamous, landed in South Africa. There was a photographer there waiting for her, just enveloped in shame. And what happened to her? She didn't just lose her job. She lost her vocation. She had to move out of New York.
Yeah, she lost her sense of self. You know, when I met her a couple of weeks later, she was saying, you know, I've forgotten who I am. You know, I wake up in the middle of the night forgetting who I am. I'm losing myself. I mean, these are things that people with PTSD say. And really, she was crushed. And things only started to get better for Justine after a year. She was cast out into the wilderness for a year. And then, you know, my book came along and it was extracted in the New York Times. And that's when things started to get better for her.
Well, I'm actually wondering about the efficacy of shaming, if it actually helps people redeem themselves. I mean, you looked at this from a couple of different perspectives. You went back historically to the American colonial era of the pillory and the public humiliation. And to Judge Ted Poe, this is Texas judge who does those, you know, sentenced people to, for instance, walk down the highway with a sign that says, I was driving drunk and killed two people for 6 months or something like that.
Yeah, I found my Ted Poe meeting so interesting because, you know, I felt like I think most people would feel, you know, this guy, he's a friend of Bush. He's this big, loud lawmaker. We kind of don't like him. So I went to see him sort of thinking that. And then I realized, speaking to the people who he had sentenced to walk up and down the road wearing those placards, they would say to me, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because people would stop their cars and they would say, you know, oh, I'm so sorry. Come with me to church. Things will be okay. When Justine Sacco was being destroyed on Twitter, nobody said things will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
No one was supporting her. In real life, we're really nice. And, you know, it was those people saying those empathetic things to that guy who'd killed two people while driving drunk that changed his life. It wasn't the punishment that changed his life. It was the empathy.
I wonder if the nature of shaming will also change, or the notion, rather, of shaming, when everybody's lives are going to be on the internet, you know, and they will have been for a long time. So you could no longer say, I didn't inhale. You know, it's probably on somebody's video somewhere.
Yeah.
Is the notion of shame going to change? Is it going to—we've leveled the playing field, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope, you know. I mean, obviously, we're living in a time now where everyone's going to be unelectable. Because not only unelectable, but nobody can be the next Daily Show host because of something that happened in their past. So, yeah, you would think it's going to have to change. You know, when somebody has been shamed, they find it almost impossible because they can understand the agony of it, and it's agony. And I think once people do that, it's really hard to go back and shame other people. So maybe when everybody has been shamed, it's going to burn itself out because you can't do it to other people when it's been done to you because you know the reality of what it feels like.
That's our previous conversation with John Ronson, author of several books, including So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is now out in paperback. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is not an easy topic to discuss, but some studies suggest that 1 out of every 10 women in their 30s suffer from urinary incontinence. Others say those numbers could be much higher, which makes sense, because wetting your pants as an adult is embarrassing, and few people want to talk about it. Producer Lauren Whaley decided it was time to open up about this growing problem and looked into treatments and technologies that are designed to help.
My has to pee in the toilet.
My son is 2, and he has mastered the toilet. He doesn't pee in his pants or wear diapers, but ever since he was born, I do. I'm 35 years old, and I buy diapers for myself.
Talking about incontinence is still one of those frontiers that's not really comfortable for many women to talk about.
That's Dr. Amy Rosenman.
I am a health sciences clinical professor at UCLA in the Department of OBGYN.
Some studies report that 1 out of 10 women my age are peeing themselves. Others say the numbers could be much, much higher. But it's tough to talk about. Peeing in your pants is embarrassing. I want to tell women that they don't have to suffer, that they're not alone. Medical professionals and a whole crop of new technologies can help. So, here's my story. I have what's called stress incontinence. Not from emotional stress, though leaking pee can cause that, but from the physical stress of coughing or jumping or wrestling and laughing with a 2-year-old. No, I'm not going to die from this. But it has changed my life. I stopped running, the activity that makes me sane, because I hated soaking through 2 pads and still coming home with wet shorts. For many women, it's a lot worse.
Severe incontinence, women stop traveling. They're embarrassed about their absorptive products and how they dispose of them, and it's major life-altering.
Urinary incontinence is what's known as a pelvic floor disorder. There are 2 other major ones. There's fecal incontinence, which is leaking poop, and organ prolapse, when the uterus or bladder or intestines actually start to sag and fall into the vagina. About 1/4 of American women have at least 1 pelvic floor disorder, and urinary incontinence is the most common. There are a ton of factors that contribute to leaking, so get ready for a long list. But first, a little more about the pelvic floor. The pelvic floor is a group of muscles in the shape of a basket. It's connected to the abs and cradles the bladder, intestines, and uterus. It helps control pee and poop and helps guide the baby out during childbirth. So, back to that list, the reasons someone might leak pee. For those of us that have had babies, hormonal changes, the weight of the baby during pregnancy, and childbirth injuries can weaken or damage the pelvic floor and cause leaking. Genetics and weaker pelvic muscle tissue can also make you more prone to leaking. Same if you're overweight or if you smoke. For older women, hormonal changes during menopause or just gravity taking over can cause leaking. And in some women, it's not muscular. The communication between brain and bladder breaks down and makes you feel like you gotta go right now. That's called urge incontinence, and it's more common in older women.
After age 60, greater than 30% of all women have some form of incontinence.
And after age 80, about 1/2 of American women leak pee. Lucky for us, younger and older, there's now an entire subspecialty in medicine built around treating pelvic floor issues. It's called urogynecology. There are also some new tech tools that have been added to the mix of treatments. Many of them are also used in pelvic floor physical therapy.
People are being a little bit more open about the fact that they're having trouble either with incontinence or even pelvic pain.
Amy Diaz is my physical therapist. She's a faculty member at the University of Southern California, Division of Biokinesiology and Physical Therapy. She also leaks urine herself. Her incontinence is from organ prolapse related to pregnancy.
Certainly, I understand the emotional side of it. I understand some of the physical symptoms.
And she's up on the latest technologies to help her patients.
So kegelme.com, have you seen this, the Kegel? So this is basically a interactive Kegel exerciser that can send information to your smartphone.
A Kegel is an exercise where you tighten your vagina and butt like you're stopping pee midstream. They don't take a ton of effort, but Dia says many women don't know how to do them correctly. And that's where this device and others like it can help.
Can you describe what that looks like?
Oh, sure. So,
just describe it.
So it looks a little bit like a dildo that you're going to insert. So as you tighten the muscles, it will cause the device to vibrate.
And all the data pop up on your smartphone via Bluetooth. But you don't have to buy a device that looks like a sex toy. There are tons of apps out there for tracking your pad usage and leaking, or reminding you to pee more frequently, or coaching you through exercises. This one is called Kegel Nation.
Contract your pelvic floor muscles and maintain them as tight as you can for as long as you can.
Thank you, Kegel Coach Meditation Man. I wonder how many of us are clenching our vaginas and butts at this exact moment.
Keep them tight, 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 tight.
Physical therapy and strengthening exercises can work. And there are other treatments too, like injecting Botox into the bladder to stop spasms, or inserting bulking agents into the urethra to beef it up.
Our field is changing rapidly, and I think that's what's fun about it. And from a prognosis perspective, I think we're only going to get better at treating these things.
Right. The new advances are exciting, but they're not going to cure everyone.
I run from, I'm in the pool. Sometimes I don't make it. Stand on the grass.
Take my friend Donna Miro. She is 70 years old and has two kinds of incontinence. She had surgery to install a big supportive mesh sling under her weakened pelvic floor muscles. That was to treat her stress incontinence, and the surgery worked. But she still has memorized the location of every McDonald's off of LA's East-West 10 freeway.
Because they're designed the same, and I know when you go in, you turn right and there's a bathroom.
That's because her urge incontinence, where she suddenly has to go right now, is still a big problem, in spite of some pretty advanced technology. She had a small device surgically implanted in her back. It gives a little bzzz when her bladder is full, so her brain gets the signal and she knows it's time to find a toilet. But she still soaks through 3 or 4 pads a day.
Okay, here's a thick, thick pad.
Donna's urogynecologist says her only option may be more surgery.
I'm not willing to go through any a really major surgery to correct this because there's no guarantee. And this is the best that anyone can do, and maybe science and technology will come up with something different.
Studies suggest that the number of American women with urinary incontinence will increase by 55% in the next 35 years due to an aging and increasingly overweight population. So innovators have their work cut out for them. But there is this new product on the market. It's for stress incontinence, so it won't help Donna, but it could help me get back to running. It looks like a tampon, but it's made out of silicone. It's called the Poise Impressa Bladder Support. It's inserted into the vagina and holds the urethra in place so it doesn't leak pee. Dr. Rosenman says it could be a game changer for women with severe stress incontinence, because even though strengthening exercises are great for mild cases, she says the only fix for terrible leaking is still surgery. The Impressa could be an alternative, and you can get it at the grocery store. Look, I don't want to leak pee, but I'm glad I'm leaking at this point in history. We have experts and inserts and apps. People are inventing stuff. We pants peers have options. Now, I gotta go. I'm Lauren Whaley. This program is part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Islamic extremists have cut a ruthless path through several failed states in the Middle East and parts of Africa. Their populations have been brutalized by armed militants enforcing Sharia law and watched defenseless as great treasures of the ancient world were pillaged or demolished before their eyes. In some cases, citizens rebel, governments fight back, or other nations intervene. We're about to hear the story of defeating a band of al-Qaeda, not by guns and soldiers, but by the courage and cunning of book lovers and scholars. The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu is Joshua Hammer's account of an operation to smuggle hundreds of thousands of sacred books and manuscripts away from Islamic thugs that overtook parts of Mali, West Africa, in 2012. It reads like a thriller or as a caper worthy of Hollywood, though few took notice while it was happening half a world away. Josh Hammer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks a lot.
So first, a little on the history of Timbuktu, which is a fabled place and a symbol of remoteness. What made it such an important center for learning?
Yeah, Timbuktu really began about 1100 AD, and by the 14th century, it had become a crossroads of the world. It was a place where the highest bend of the Niger River, the third longest river in Africa, met the Sahara, met the desert, met the river. And thus, it became a hugely important trading post for camel caravans coming across the desert from as far away as Europe, meeting traders from sub-Saharan Africa. So it became hugely wealthy, and from that wealth came emerged a scholastic tradition as well. It had a couple of very benevolent kings who imported architects and scientists and poets and writers to the city, and by the 16th century it had emerged as one of the great scholastic centers of the Middle East and Africa. And out of that came this incredible tradition of manuscript writing.
Well, we often get a very simplistic or, I guess, monolithic impression of how Islamic societies function. You describe Timbuktu with more nuance as a place in constant cultural flux. What was going on there?
Well, Timbuktu citizens, most of them adhered to the Sufi tradition of Islam, which is traditionally mystical, moderate. They sing, they dance, they worship saints. They do all the things that the fundamentalists who emerged out of Arabia would find reprehensible. So that Sufi tradition really found itself in constant conflict over the centuries with this much more austere, severe, punitive form of Islam that had come out of the birthplace of the Prophet Muhammad and spread slowly west.
Well, it's in a neighborhood in Timbuktu where your central character, Abdel Kader Haidara, grew up, surrounded by his family's vast collection of ancient works. He was chosen from his father's 12 children to be the steward of the collection of manuscripts, a job he wasn't initially eager to embrace. But then you describe him going to great lengths to build the collection of the government library who he was working for. So what did he find and how?
Well, Haider, as you said, he was reluctant. He had a dream of becoming a businessman, as he told me. I wanted to make money. But he was finally persuaded to venture off, and he set to begin collecting these manuscripts that had been dispersed out of Timbuktu over the centuries, many of them hidden away. So he would follow clues and would travel by camel caravan. He would travel on foot sometimes for days, even weeks. He would show up in these villages carrying money sort of secreted away in a pouch, money that was given to him by the governments of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, the wealthy families of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia who financed this effort to rediscover the lost manuscripts of Timbuktu. And he would negotiate with villagers, get information that this guy in this village has a chest full of manuscripts from the 14th century. And many people were extremely reluctant to even admit they had these works. The French colonial army had been through there in the 19th century and early 20th century, had stolen a lot of these books to take off to libraries in France. And so people would see him come into town and would deny it. No, we don't have anything for you. But over time, he became more and more adept at persuading people to show him their treasures and to part with their treasures in order to fill this wonderful library in Timbuktu.
It reads, you know, like an adventure or detective book in parts. But then by 2012, a coup against the president opened up the way for these militants from Northwest Africa mostly to gain power. But Timbuktu was a pretty happening place by then. There were hotels and internet cafes. You know, there was a festival in the desert. What did the Islamists want?
Well, the Islamists, and it wasn't just that coup against the president. That was kind of the coup de grace that brought them to, that caused the Malian army to flee and collapse in disarray. But before that, there had been a steady growth of these guys in the desert. They plundered the arsenals of Libya after Gaddafi fell during the Arab Spring. Their aim was to establish territory. This was kind of a new strategy that al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda, had never really put into effect, and essentially capture territory. So that, in fact, is exactly what they did.
And they were just brutal about it.
They didn't start off that terribly, actually. They had a compact with another group of rebels, the Tuaregs, who were these Berber nomadic inhabitants of the Sahara, who also came out of that moderate Islam I was talking about in North Africa. So they had a deal with those guys that they were going to conquer the country together, share power. However, as soon as they got control, they pretty quickly swept the Tuaregs aside. And then about 3 months after capturing Timbuktu, and with the captured in April, so by July they had imposed a very harsh regime that involved stamping out music, banning anything but on the radio except the Quran, forcing women to dress in the most conservative clothes to cover their faces, prohibiting smoking, drinking, everything, and then beginning this whole whipping people who did not subscribe to their form of Islam, and then beginning to mete out very harsh punishments, including executions, including amputations of hands and feet, and things like that.
Well, history has shown us that Islamic extremists who take over failed states often destroy their antiquities. We're speaking with Josh Hammer. He's a longtime journalist and foreign correspondent who's written a new book called The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. It's about a group of book lovers and librarians who turned into a band of smugglers in order to save hundreds of thousands of sacred books and manuscripts threatened by an Islamic takeover in Mali, West Africa. So Abdel Haidara, he organized a group to smuggle these rare manuscripts away.
That's right. He realized pretty early on, even before the Islamists began their real harsh regime that I was just finished talking about, he had a sense, and certainly he was surrounded by people who had a fear that at some point along the line the manuscripts were going to be endangered. Because we should point out that these were books, a lot of them were Qurans and holy books, but other books were secular, and they celebrated love. There were handbooks about better sex. There were books that celebrated music, romantic poetry, all sorts of science, all subjects and authors that the Islamists considered haram or forbidden. So people were telling him, you know, these are not going to be safe in the big library. So within a month of the capture of the city, he gathered a small group of supporters together, and they began secretly moving the manuscripts out of these libraries. There were about 50 libraries in Timbuktu at the time. They had to move these manuscripts, pack them all into trunks in the dead of night, and then sneak them out of the libraries into a network of safe houses that they had found scattered around Timbuktu. Mm. So that was a month-long process that, again, had to happen basically under the noses of the al-Qaeda occupiers, who had Islamic police driving around the city in pickup trucks looking for a suspicious activity.
Yeah, so it was a pretty brazen thing, and big risks. He was arrested once by the Islamic police. What would they have done to him had they found him out?
He wasn't arrested, actually. It wasn't him, because he's an older man. He was in his 50s at that point. He had six kids, two wives. He got this thing off the ground, but by May of 2012, he had ensconced himself in Bamako, the capital, which was not in jihadi hands, 660 miles to the south, and began he made a couple of trips back to Timbuktu, but he really entrusted his faithful deputy and nephew, 25-year-old dynamo named Mohamed Touré, to be the hands-on guy in Timbuktu. And it was Mohamed Touré, in fact, who was arrested twice and held and questioned. At one point, he was actually caught in the act of taking these manuscripts out of a library in a trunk. It happened, unfortunately for him, one of the leading jihadis in the city, a guy with a nickname Redbeard, literally ran into him as he was exiting the library carrying this trunk, accused him of theft, hauled him up before the Sharia court, and he came very close to being sentenced to amputation. But he was able, basically, with the help of Abdelkader Haider directing things in Bamako, making lots of phone calls, and got him off.
Well, though they have airstrikes by the French, once the colonial rulers of Mali finally did oust these al-Qaeda militants from Mali, there's still a lot of simmering tension and power going on there now. I was wondering if anyone you spoke to was afraid for their lives still.
Abdelkader Haider, I talked to just yesterday. He said, you know, first of all, I just want to congratulate you. Thank you. I'm hearing all this, you know, the response has been good, but I also have to tell you that I'm fearful. I'm worried about being presented as this guy who defeated al-Qaeda, you know, who pulled a fast one on al-Qaeda, and I felt really bad. I mean, I don't think that when we sat down 2 years ago and he told me the story of what he did, that he imagined that 2.5 years later, al-Qaeda would still be a force to be reckoned with in the country. Particularly because at that time the French had, you know, triumphantly killed hundreds of jihadis and pretty much expelled them from the towns, driven them deep into the desert. Nobody really at that time imagined that they would be able to regather strength and begin carrying out terrorist attacks across this region. As they, you know, they struck a hotel in Bamako, killed a whole bunch of foreigners. They've attacked hotels and killed foreigners and locals, and so nobody imagined that this would, they would still be a potent, dangerous force. And so Abdelkader is basically is in a tough position right now.
Mali's not a place that we think of as a geopolitical hotbed, but indicative, as you're pointing out, of so many vulnerable failed states throughout the world. Now, you've covered conflicts for a long time and point out that the takeover in Mali was connected to the fallout of the Iraq War, the uprisings of the Arab Spring, especially Libya, what's going on in Syria now. Are we likely to see more Malis, you know, more threatened antiquities not saved by brave and ingenious people like Abdelkader?
Well, that's a very good question. And one hopes, you know, there's been some signs in the last few months that ISIS or Islamic State is beginning to weaken. They've lost a lot of territory. I read an interesting story, I think, in the New York Times that said that we've begun to strike their cash, literally blowing up their money. So, you know, these are hopeful signs that this group is on the defensive now, certainly capable of carrying out terrorist attacks in Europe. We know these cells exist. But in their home turf, they seem to be losing a lot of ground. So, on the other hand, this is a region of chaos and turbulence. The post-Arab Spring really has left this region with two choices. It seems either the chaos of places like Libya and continuing warfare, or the brutal dictatorship of an Egypt. There's no good options in this part of the world right now. The hopes of the Arab Spring have really dissipated, and even if the Islamic State is finally defeated over the next couple of years, you still got this vacuum there, and it's you still got the forces of fundamentalist Islam and radical Islam. So I have a sense that this is going to go on for the foreseeable future, and that new failed states could well emerge out of the wreckage of what's been going on in that part of the world.
Well, Josh Hammer, I'm so grateful you brought us a story of great hope and ingenuity that operating there now. Thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot. Great to talk about this stuff.
Joshua Hammer is former correspondent and bureau chief for Newsweek and author of The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. There's much more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for listening to that story of art overcoming extremism. There is so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including the Word of Mouth podcast, which you can listen to on your own schedule. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth, NHPR, in iTunes. And do us a favor, if you like the podcast, rate it on iTunes. That'll help other people find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.